North America's largest wholesale food distributor, Sysco Foods, recently had to stop delivering food to some of its customers because it did not have enough workers. That this giant of food could not deliver leads us to ask, can the city relearn how to feed itself?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned in to the 1289th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Valparaiso who are tuned into the Food Chain podcast at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, a couple of decades ago, I was standing on a hillside overlooking the Rogue Valley of southern Oregon. The occasion was the taking of an establishing shot for a piece on Survivalist for NBC Magazine with David Brinkley. With a camera rolling our talent, Jack Perkins said, "Beyond you could see the Rogue Valley. This is where the survivalist feels safe enough to live." And indeed, one could see numerous small survivalist ranchettes dotting the fertile valley's floor. But nowhere could one see crops growing. And so, on an impulse, I turned to our guide, Nancy Mac Tappan, and said, "We should make a pamphlet on ways to make money by farming those small parcels of land." Nancy said, "That's a great idea." And a few weeks later, she called to say, "Michael, I've sold your book to a publisher. When can you finish it?" When I went looking for who made money farming small parcels of land, I ran across a very interesting statistic in the Census of Agriculture. Whereas the average acre of farmland in the heart of America's heartland was earning a little over $300 per acre per year, the average acre of farmland in the city of San Francisco was earning $76,421 per acre per year. Clearly, the money is in the city. A decade later, I published Metro Farm, the guide to growing for profit in or near the city for the city. In an era of get big or get out agriculture, Metro Farm was greeted as a heresy by conventional agriculture. I was told in many ways, you can't succeed by being small, you have to get big. But wait, this just in. Fox Business reports that North America's largest wholesale food distributor, Sysco Foods, recently had to stop delivering food to some of its customers around the country due to an unprecedented labor shortage. And in an earnings call to its investors, Sysco also reported that food shortages and price increases are putting a lot of pressure on its ability to generate a profit. And so I persist in asking, can the city relearn how to feed itself? Well, here to help us dig for an answer today, we have Rob Benenton, who is with the University of California Agriculture Natural Resources Department. Rob is the Bay Area Urban Agriculture Advisor. Rob, so pleased to have you with us today.
Good morning.
Well, Rob, you know, there was a time where I never thought I would have the opportunity to talk with somebody from the University of California about growing food in or near the city and for the city. And yet, here you are, and you've got quite a program going at UC Berkeley. Do you want to give us a quick thumbnail?
So actually, we're not based on the campus. We're a cooperative extension, so we're housed in our local county agencies. And so my main offices are Hayward and Concord. And in both cases, we're actually housed in the local county agriculture department. That's what makes us cooperative. If it weren't for our county's support of our office efforts and infrastructure, we wouldn't be able to operate. And our goal is to develop and implement an applied research and education program around growing food in and around cities and support urban farmers and urban growers doing just that.
I just read a report somewhere that suggests that approximately 30% of the food in metropolitan areas is now being sourced locally, which is to say we're doing what you're teaching people how to do.
Exactly. And more folks can do so. And there's efforts to actually commingle small urban farm spots from yards and a variety of land use models that exist.
Do you see, Rob, in your position, there with cooperative extension. Do you see more acceptance of the whole notion of local agriculture with academia?
More and more, it's becoming accepted that food can be grown in and around cities, and the historical trend of excluding agriculture, even in small scales, is going more and more by the wayside through progressive policies. So, yes.
And you know that recent news about Sysco being unable to deliver food because of labor shortages, because of price increases, and so on, kind of lends credence to the notion that maybe we should start thinking about how to feed ourselves.
Most definitely. And one of the key access points with being able to feed yourself is, what land will you grow on? How will that be possible so that you can cultivate produce and be able to actually be a small-scale producer?
Where does one start even thinking about being a small-scale producer? In the first place, I would think that you would have to recognize that there is an opportunity there. And so to find that opportunity, you would have to kind of look for a precedent. Where on earth does one look for precedent for successful small-scale farmers, in your estimation?
Well, throughout different parts of the Bay Area, there are groups growing produce on various land models. One is the Sunol Agriculture Park, which is San Francisco Public Utilities land, managed in coordination with the Alameda County Resource Conservation District. And that's about less than 10 acres, and most of those growers are on less than an acre or so. And there are other examples where folks are accessing lands in park districts, school districts, utility lands, and also justice lands occasionally as well.
Rob, when I was working on my book, Metro Farm, I had to look far and wide for people who are actually making money farming small parcels of land. And I found so many people who were losing money. Those people who were making money farming small parcels of land, I found to be very competitive people. Do you see that as well? Do you see that the small farmers who are succeeding have somehow learned how to compete in a marketplace dominated by large-scale producers?
Yes and no. There's sort of mixed nuances to both sides. One is yes, in the sense that small urban growers are finding ways to grow high-value crops. So some of them are thinking about or growing microgreens, specialty mushrooms, various kinds of culinary herbs, high-value, more fragile crops in many cases. And then others of them have dived in the opposite direction from a for-profit model into nonprofit work, and really are addressing food security concerns in their very local communities, and in many cases, in very low-income pockets of the counties of the Bay Area where there's historically been disinvestment. So those are doing more nonprofit work, and oftentimes they connect not only as micro-growers as urban farmers, but also complementing with larger suppliers that are also diverse growers as well.
How does a nonprofit fund itself in growing food for food deserts?
In many cases, they're diversifying their approach. In some cases, they wind up also coordinating educational and cultural and social programs in community, sometimes hosting workshops, sometimes sharing. Might be, for example, a Fiesta de Flores, where maybe they connect with the Latino community and are also doing salsa making workshops, as just one example. And so they're really diversifying their revenue stream. They may use their urban farm space in the city as a space to actually also have a small farm stand. They may connect with local affinity markets like the Freedom Farmers Market in Oakland or the Acoma Farmers Market in East Oakland, both of which are African-American affinity markets. And so the approach varies in many ways, but it often starts with connecting community residents to land and growing food on those spaces as a starting point.
You know, if you were to fly over a metropolitan area, you would see a lot of empty land. So how does one connect with those unused parcels of land within a metropolitan area?
It's very much about direct relationships in many, many cases. You know, successfully securing affordable, stable access to land is a major challenge facing the Bay Area's urban farmers, California's, and in many cases, much of the country's urban farmers. And it really can be a significant barrier to starting or scaling up an urban farming operation. In many cases, many of the groups will start on a small plot that they may be able to access through their local parks district, through their utility districts such as East Bay MUD or PG&E. Others have started in conjunction with faith-based lands where a temple, mosque, synagogue, or church may have land that they can spare. And then from there, they've worked towards scaling up as best as they can in a variety of ways. And these really happen in some cases through very formalized agreements and in other cases through fairly informal situations that are based on really relationships. And it becomes hard because, you know, if those relationships, they're built on a level of trust, but in the case of agencies that manage land, that are ultimately land stewards in the public trust, sometimes the staff from those organizations move on, they retire, they transition into other roles. And so sometimes that change up can be bumpy for the local organization growing on that land area.
If you don't own it and pay all the taxes on it, then you're always vulnerable to one extent or another. I'm thinking about a book put together about urban agriculture by a guy named Jacques Schmitt, who produced it for the United Nations, I believe it was, and it was a look at urban agriculture around the world. In it, he described a lot of what you're talking about as whatever land there is can be made to produce if you have that relationship. And he also talked a lot about the kinds of people who are doing this, and he seemed to point a lot at women as being successful at the business of metropolitan agriculture. Do you have any thoughts about that?
I mean, absolutely. So many of our urban farming food justice organizations are founded and led by women and women of color specifically. Common Vision comes to mind with Wanda Stewart, Acta Nonverba with Kelly Carlisle, and then also some of the micro-scale commercial farming groups like Pollinate Farm and Garden, which was actually originally out of Pollinate Farm and Garden Supply Store, which used to be on Fruitvale Avenue before COVID, and then really converted over to growing on a small acreage in the Oakland Hills with Yolanda Burrell. So absolutely. The involvement and oversight of women in the process of urban farming really has far-reaching implications and ripple effects, because also other women see their leadership and ultimately, in many cases, wind up following similar paths and learning from them as well. And also, there are, in many cases, whether actually or sort of metaphorically, they're often the mothers of the communities. They're those who care about the local health and well-being of their community residents and that they have access to nutritious and affordable food. Absolutely.
We're going to take a quick break, folks. This is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What, with Rob Benetton, who is with the University of California Ag and Natural Resources Department. He is the Bay Area Urban Agriculture Advisor. And when we come back from this break, we want to talk about how those farmers get their hands on these properties and where they start farming. This is the Food Chain. Right back.
And now, more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, we are back. We're talking about urban agriculture. Rob calls it urban agriculture. I call it metropolitan agriculture. Other people call it city agriculture. I've even heard it referred to as mini farming. What about all those words, Rob?
Well, you know, agriculture is really about growing and cultivating food for one's own consumption and the consumption of larger scale, certainly family, community, and then at the commercial scale. But urban agriculture really is defined as the production, marketing, distribution, and exchange of food and agricultural products in and around cities. And this can take up a variety of potential models. They can be rooftop farms, they can be commingled backyard spaces, they can be small community gardens. There's a variety of potential land use typologies that this applies towards. But it includes food in and around cities. And in many cases, supplies can be complemented between urban and more peri-urban growers. Close enough to market, but also far enough that there's the potential for larger scale commercial agriculture. And then also some of that will vary by the crop type. Some crops are more fragile and more sensitive and so need to be closer to market and are of a higher value.
People have been told for many years that you have to get big or get out. And yet one of the people I interviewed for Metro Farm said, people always think they need to get bigger, but that is not necessarily so. My work area is 140 feet by 40 feet, and it will hold 500,000 cuttings at one time. And he, of course, was propagating ornamental plants, which is a big market for a big product for city folks, too, because we don't just live by bread alone. We love to have our flowering plants as well. Any thoughts about the kinds of crops that are suitable for urban agriculture?
Sure. So potentially high-value microgreens, specialty mushrooms, various kinds of the solanaceae are often in high demand. And also the brassicas, broccolis, corn, I'm sorry, broccolis, cauliflowers, lettuces, etc., all fall within potentials for urban ag. Really, you can grow a large variety of crops in and around cities. So it's really about the mix of what the demand is that might be driving it, and then also what the soil type and conditions are on the ground. How much water do you need is certainly a key consideration at this time, given the drought.
You know, when people say, what should I grow? I always say there is only one thing to grow, and that is what the market tells you to grow. If you're growing what you want to grow and not what the market wants you to grow, you'll shortly find yourself into big trouble.
Absolutely. If your purpose is really commercial growing, you know, urban agriculture really extends beyond home consumption and education and includes urban market gardens, innovative food production methods that maximize production in small areas, community-supported agriculture based in urban areas, and family farms in the metropolitan green belts. But there are also feelings that exist around the Bay, around historically land being on territories that had indigenous occupation previously. And so an acknowledgement of that history is also often really brought into conversations in more recent times than ever before. And the interconnectedness of human settlements with those natural resources becomes key. So it really depends on your optic. You know, if your thing is commercial growing, absolutely, the market will very much drive what you're trying to grow, and also proximity to market and conditions like soil and water. But in addition to that, community connectivity with the land also can augment local health and ecosystem benefits as well.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that also I think is important to, if you're going to invest time and effort into growing a crop, is to know that whatever you're going to grow for the city should be special in some way. And in saying that, I'm trying to get people to fix on distinguishing between commodities and specialty crops. You know, you take a tomato, for example. A tomato grown on thousands of acres someplace else is a commodity because it's just a tomato. And a tomato is a tomato and is a tomato. But if you're growing it for the city market, what does city people want? They don't want to eat, really, don't want to eat commodity tomatoes. They want to eat something that's special, perhaps a dry farmed heritage tomato or something like that, that, you know, that is picked ripe on the vine. And that tomato then becomes very special. Your thoughts?
Yes, absolutely. So the concept in that discussion really gets into value added products and ways that growing food in around cities can ultimately also be done in with methods that actually add value to the ultimate product, whether it's market value or perceived value based on how the crop is grown, whether it's an heirloom variety in tomatoes, for example, but also, you know, can that crop contribute to cottage food operations? Can that crop be direct sold to a restaurant where it's highlighted for its proximity to the farm on the menu? All of these add basic value to the overall construct and perception of ultimately those crops and where they're coming from. And so I would also add, you know, we're in a time of climate change. So think about carbon sequestration. The closer we are actually to our crops, the less carbon footprint in many cases.
That would fit in with Michael Olson's second law of the food chain, which is the farther you go from the source of your food, the less control you have over what's in your food and the environment, come to think of it. So kind of works like that. The other thing, of course, that's really striking with respect to urban or metropolitan agriculture is the technology involved. Because if you're out there in the countryside, in the heartland, growing commodities, chances are you're farming essentially with money instead of with time. And so there's two different kinds of technologies involved. So if you're looking at farming in or near the city for the city, you have to consider where to look for the technologies to get the most out of the least. And that is not necessarily commodity agriculture technologies. So where do you recommend people look for their technologies, Rob?
Well, you know, controlled environment agriculture is growing in leaps and bounds, and there are efforts slowly beginning to basically support more CEA, more controlled environment ag in the Bay Area. There's a company called Plenty, that's one company, and there are others as well. In Southern California, there are also efforts to really blossom the pathway of controlled environment ag. But what I would say is, while controlled environment ag can help augment markets, ultimately, so much of urban farming really centers on food security at a hyper-local level and the value of reconnecting communities that have historically been disinvested in back to the land and the stewardship of the land. So, you know, in California, there have been a number of policies that have actually been passed to support this, and these include the Community Food Production Act, the Cottage Food Operations and also the home kitchen operations as well. So we're now at a point in California where you can go farm to fork all the way at a very, very micro scale, and really do so with, in some ways, with less technology than previously thought. So technology certainly has a place. It will augment the food supply, but also keeping land in production and keeping land as open space as we urbanize will be very, very important. You know, there's an expected population increase of about 66% between 2015 or so up until 2050. And currently, globally, we have about 795 million folks experiencing hunger or malnutrition. So there's a massive need for reconsidering ways to grow food. And to the degree it's possible to design food growing cultivation opportunities into cities, I think that may be one of the long-term pathways for success. So rooftop growing, vertical farming, indoor growing, all certainly have a place. But it's going to be most important to also couple that with how do we do that with affordable housing? How do we make sure that low-income residents with less access to resources may also engage in all of the benefits of growing one's own food, Michael?
You know, F.H. King, as Secretary of Agriculture at the turn of the last century, went to China to explore how they did things. And he describes this one description he made of meeting a farmer walking down the road. And he had on his shoulders the manure pails. You know, he had a bamboo pole with two manure pails. And so they stopped for a conversation. And it was the farmer told F.H. King that he had a quarter acre of land, and that on that quarter acre, he sustained 20 people in his household. And besides that, generated a substantial cash income from selling his goods in the local market. I often think about that in terms of how that kind of farmer of 40 centuries technology could be applied to, you know, the small parcels of land in or near the city. The farmer of 40 centuries, of course, had a lot of knowledge about how to use that property intensively and get the most out of it. And intercrop and succession cropping and so on and so on and so on, which in my estimation makes that farmer a very smart person. Can we be that smart?
Absolutely. So, you know, science has gone the direction and Western sort of educational thought around agriculture has really gone in the direction, especially in the last 50 years or so, towards monoculture cropping and large-scale field row cropping. But the potential for polyculture is actually rooted in ancient traditions that long predate us. And the understanding that some crops can grow together through intercropping and successional cropping and companion planting actually is very historically based. And we have essentially been taught to lean towards larger scale and towards really single crop monoculture directions over time. But in small spaces, one actually almost has to do polyculture food growing in order to optimize the resource use and maximize the use of the space. And I think it's also really important that we sort of flip our understanding on the word use, right? Many of those same ancient traditions were very much about having a level of balance with the land on which they're cultivating and stewarding, and ensuring that the current resources that are used, the soil and the water, the air, ultimately remain available for future generations. And that's really the definition of sustainability over time. You know, we're now at a point in the globe, on planet Earth, where greater than 50% of the world's population is living in cities. So we definitely have to think about how cities develop and think about new and different ways to grow food. And technology will be a part of that, but also understanding that the land has an internal, personalized, identifiable cultural relevance for us. And in many cases, we are not on land that we're indigenously part of our own cultures, is a key part of that conversation as well.
Well, okay, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, there is another aspect to this business of metropolitan or urban agriculture that we need to talk about and come to grips with, I think. And that is, well, you better stay tuned to find out. This is The Food Chain, Michael Olson with Rob Bennington. He is the Urban Ag Advisor for the metropolitan area of San Francisco. Wow, that's a big deal. Right back.
You can earn a substantial income by farming for the city. All you need to do is take your crop to market and win the competition for the consumer dollars. There is a well-proven strategy for winning this competition. You will find it embedded in MetroFarm, the guide to growing in or near the city for the city.
Polyface Farms, Joel Salatin.
Few how-to books could be more appropriate for our times than MetroFarm, a truly comprehensive manual. MetroFarm makes the whole embedded food system doable. It's a must-read.
USDA Director Bud Kerr.
Big book. MetroFarm describes the agronomic, economic, and managerial concepts required to generate substantial profits from agricultural locales near metropolitan areas.
Before you plant your seeds, pick up a copy of the Ben Franklin Book of the Year award-winning MetroFarm. Then plant your seeds and win the dollars. MetroFarm.com. MetroFarm.com.
Hi, folks. How many of you out there love to garden? Wouldn't it be nice to grow some of your own food? Or maybe a flower garden would brighten your day. Well, now you can have the pleasures of gardening without all that effort. You don't need a tractor. You don't need a rototiller. All you need is the Knox Garden Box, a heavily constructed, portable, elevated garden on legs that can virtually change the way you've gardened in the past. The Knox Garden Box can be set up anywhere. Yes, you can place it right on concrete. For those with bad backs, you've got critters and gophers, no space or maybe no dirt. With the Knox Garden Box, the therapy of garden is now the prescription for good mental health. The way to find your fabulous Knox Garden Box is by logging on to knoxgardenbox.com. That's K-N-O-X, gardenbox.com. Or by calling 831-461-9430.
History buffs, this tale from Michael Olson's Tales from a Tin Can took place while the USS Dale steamed through the Bering Sea, January 1943.
We took some terrible waves up there. One time a big groundswell rolled us over so far I thought we'd never make it back. I was on the lee deck when the ship went over into that roll. Luckily, I was able to grab onto a bulkhead handrail, and when the Dale went over, my feet left the deck. I hung there with nothing between my feet and the ocean but air. I was scared. She went over on her beam, paused for a minute, then she shuddered and shook because one of her propellers was out of the water and thrashing air. Slowly, very slowly, she rolled back toward the vertical, and my feet found the deck again. That wave scared the devil out of me.
Tales from a Tin Can contains 424 tales by 44 sailors aboard the USS Dale, from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. Order your Father's Day copy at talesfromatincan.com. That's talesfromatincan.com. Talesfromatincan.com.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back. This is the Food Chain radio program. Folks, you know, the largest food distributor in the North America, Sysco Foods, had to stop delivering food because it was short of labor. And besides that, the price increases and the food shortages are making it so hard for that giant to deliver food. And what if it can't? I heard from a person that I trust who is in Slidell, Louisiana, which just hosted Hurricane Ida. And after 3 weeks, she said there is one restaurant in town and it only has six things to eat. That's your choice. And, you know, in thinking about those two bits of news, you just got to wonder if there isn't a way that we can feed ourselves, we who live in cities. And Rob, as we've talked our way along, you've made mention quite a bit about how we're reconnecting with each other, both culturally and I guess even spiritually, and how food can be the mechanism where we can bring that connection back together. So in thinking about that, well, you have the farmer who's growing food, but you also need the consumer to participate in this industry, do you not?
You do. You need the consumer, and to the degree that the consumer can know the farmer, know where their food comes from, develop a bridge of trust with that farmer, or even a group of farmers, there's some value in that. And that really lends itself to resilience in times of trouble, in times of hurricanes and earthquakes and fires and pandemics. The ability to really know and trust your farmer, know how they've treated the land and how they've grown their crops, really builds social capital in communities. And it's really needed at this time.
So how do we, in thinking about reestablishing this whole world of metropolitan agriculture, how do we approach the city person and sell them on the idea that they should think local first about their food?
Well, it's really about, in many cases, many cities are beginning to go in that direction, and some have been doing so for a while. Some cities have community garden programs, others have adopt-a-lot programs, but getting them to understand that there's actual local and community value with local stewardship of neighbors actually growing food together has taken some time. You know, we're often in a space where real estate has financial value, but the positive externalities of land stewardship aren't always, in some cases, fully acknowledged. And so one example of neighbors coming together in the East Bay is in the Fruitvale District. It's a group called Canticle Farm. They're in the Fruitvale neighborhood, and they've actually successfully worked with their neighbors to break down fences and grow food and community together. They've also daylighted a stream, and collectively over time are really building local resilience in case of potential for trouble in the future in terms of natural disasters and biological outbreaks of pandemics like COVID-19.
I recently spoke with a young lady who is establishing a neighborhood compost program. So she got a bunch of buckets and handed them out to her neighbors and said, please give me your scraps and we'll compost them for you instead of throwing them away. And in doing that, she struck up a conversation with her various neighbors, and now knows those people whose gardens she always walked past, and now has that relationship going with them. So in essence, instead of just throwing trash into the garbage, she's using the leftovers to establish a connection with all of her neighbors and to regenerate the soil. So it seems like such a win-win thing to do, this business of regrowing our own food supply.
Absolutely. And in California, where so much of the land development historically has been urban and suburban sprawl, getting to know your neighbors, getting to know the kinds of foods they grow, the cultures where they're from, their approaches to community development, and composting with them as a cooperative effort is very much the direction of the future. The potential for community-based composting, where our biodegradables at the end of the line don't necessarily go very far, but stay within a small area, perhaps a block or a neighborhood, and folks actually participate in composting together as much as they do in food growing together, really has the potential to really build the food safety net, right? Mm-hmm. The food web, so to speak.
So it seems like what you and I are talking about here is a decentralized world where we're trying our best to take care of ourselves rather than relying on a centralized authority like Sysco Foods to take care of us for us. Wow, is there room enough for a decentralized world in a world of central authority? What do you think?
Absolutely. Where food can be hyper-locally sourced and identified, where we know groups that grow food on 2 or 3 yard spaces and have a community-supported agriculture, kind of like a buying club, where they pick up their food from that farmer or group of farmers every week. There's certainly opportunity there, and it is a very much decentralized approach. Cities, counties can really support this effort. You know, so many in urban areas now are also often living in apartments. And so where there are parks districts that support local cultivation by community residents, those are pathways forward as well. And what they also do is they create experiential learning opportunities. They create spaces for communities to get to know each other, to break down fences, but also those metaphorical fences in our minds that have happened over long periods of time that have resulted in imbalances in urban development over time. So that, unfortunately, some communities have been not as invested in as other communities. And so it's about raising all boats so that ultimately we can grow together, Michael.
I some time ago came across an interesting concept that I packaged into the what I call the 2x2 pledge. And the 2x2 pledge is simply I pledge to spend $2 per day on local food, which is to say food with its farmer's face on it. And I pledge to talk to other people into taking the 2x2 pledge. So if everybody in our market with 500,000 people were to do that, it would be $1 million per day, which goes around 7 times before it disappears. And so if you look at the economies of that, you got a multi-billion dollar a year industry going without having to spend an extra penny. And in that local economy, you have lots of room for people to thrive and have good work and hire good workers and eat good food. And it's just a simple matter of $2 per day of food, local food. What do you think?
Absolutely. And, you know, those are nowadays called sustainable economies. And folks are thinking more and more along those lines. You know, how can they keep their dollars in their local neighborhood more and more and uplift ultimately the community over time? In order to do that, one also needs to really form agreements, you know, connect with folks who have land and form agreements in terms of sustainable economies, in terms of long-term land tenure. And so there are organizations that actually help out with that. Change Lab Solutions has a joint use agreement with whereby one can use that agreement as a template for initiating a school garden on school properties. Sustainable Economies Law Center also has a number of agreements that they have, and they also provide legal support for farmers getting started and food and ag businesses getting going in a variety of models, whether it's a cooperative or a limited liability corporation. So definitely the potential for keeping those dollars in the local economy can again, rebalance, right, create local value. And ultimately, the goal is to keep our residents in our communities, prevent economic displacement, reduce the amount of, change that's negative, right? When the rents go up, people get displaced. They, over time, have a tougher time being able to actually pay the bills. And so gentrification can occur in many of these neighborhoods as well. So growing food adds value, but we want to find a way to have it be, whether it's a for-profit or a nonprofit, have it be a way that also supports local jobs and local income streams that keep the local residents in the spaces and communities in which they grew up, in which they're nurturing.
Well, Rob Bennington, you have been working at this for a long time, and you have assembled an incredible body of knowledge with respect to urban or metropolitan agriculture. Where, when people come up to you and say, Rob, I'm going to start farming, where do I start? Where do they start?
Well, in the urban areas, a good place to start is the University of California's Ag and Natural Resources Urban Agriculture website. So if you were to simply Google UCANR, Urban Agriculture, a whole plethora of resources come up on that website about starting an urban farm, production issues and considerations, legal basics, zoning, permitting, food safety concerns and regulations and compliance, and what you do and don't necessarily need to know about small-scale farming and urban farming and being within the base level of food safety scope and compliance. And then also marketing and business development, right? How do you be successful without losing your shirt over actually starting an urban farm? Because, you know, every business is a new effort. Every nonprofit is also a new effort. And so you may have to have some nuanced and innovative approaches in order to be successful over time and really meet the mission, vision, and values of your organization or your business's goals.
And what about land? Where you made mention that you got to figure out how to establish a relationship with those who control the land. You don't need to own land, but you somehow need to control it, correct?
That's right. So having oversight over land, being able to access it for the longer term, gaining a sense of land tenure, so that one can cultivate for the longer term and make base level investments onto the property to improve the soil, potentially thinking about small dwarf fruit tree orchards. Those kinds of efforts take time. And so establishing agreements, potentially connecting with a local community land trust like the Agrarian Commons, or even thinking about land use agreements, right? Joint use agreements. There are templates that exist ultimately in place. And what are the water resources? How will you access them? What is the infrastructure like? How is the soil quality? All of these can begin to be explored through the UCANR Urban Agriculture website. And we're developing a land access fact sheet towards this as well, which will be released very shortly.
a land access fact sheet. I love the idea, and which is what we have to do. We have to figure out somehow how to get control, be it for long enough, of those all of those vacant parcels of land. And that's the service that you're going to provide, and that's a pretty good deal. Well, Rob, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you all of you folks at UCANR for the work that you do and in making it possible to reinvent this business of metropolitan or urban agriculture so that we can go about feeding ourselves. So thanks, Rob, for joining us.
Thanks so much.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends miss the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.